I must apologize beforehand. This is highly improvised. It's a couple of thoughts of
finished.
Time's up.
I haven't heard the bell. You forgot a bell. You can't say this without a bell. It's a couple of thoughts brought together and a couple of old slides even that I adapted quickly early this morning after I got up, and then mixed it up with all kinds of other things that I was involved in. So I hope you will forgive me for a somewhat rambling presentation here. Let's start with an initial statement here. Beyond science, there's a spirit of science, and the spirit is not necessarily fed by science. So I'm speaking here about not by science alone. I believe science and the practice of science and the exposure to science is something that does contribute to building the scientific mind, whatever it may be. But there are also lots of other things that do. And I quote in this regard Paul Roman, a theoretical physicist who currently lives in Germany, comes originally from Hungary. He said once to me that in school he learned more about science by taking a class in Latin than through all the science lessons that he followed. I found that quite interesting, actually. I must say my own experience of having been in school at a time that before in school I was exposed to science, I exposed myself to science already by reading books and by doing experiments at home. And in school I was confronted with science, I was heavily disappointed and thought someone is going to destroy the fun that I'm having in it. And the fun was exactly at the level of the what I call the spirit of science, or the scientific mind. So that's one thought that I wanted to put forward and for your consideration and discussion after this is over. Before I do that, let me also expose you to a little bit of my experience in training teachers in developing countries, particularly in Africa, in one of the poorest countries at the time, in Mozambique. There was absolutely nothing, and I was supposed to lead kids of about, 20 years old, to become teachers of science. And they merely came out of secondary school, had no background in science, and I was supposed to help them learn how to become good science teachers, particularly from the methodological point of view. First of all, I found that the most fundamental methodological issue in teaching science is that you have to have a very good and profound grasp of the content of what you're teaching. So that was absolutely absent. Then second, in order to teach a subject of that nature in circumstances where you have nothing, but when I say nothing, I mean nothing, you have to be extremely creative. So the challenge of developing creativity in combination with developing insight and knowledge, in combination with the development of a capacity to formulate problems, and in combination then with the capacity to think about resources and opportunities and challenges and bring that all together in solutions, and doing so collaboratively with your fellow students and with a little help of someone who is slightly more competent, which was myself, but basically capitalizing on one's own experience, because that is what people would be working with in their professional life. That was a huge challenge. In addition to that, you're working in a culture that is sort of alien to the spirit of science as I knew it, as a Westerner, or a Northerner, if you wish, in which all kinds of stories circulate that account for natural phenomena. For instance, the fact that, as they see it, lightning is a bird that comes down to lay eggs, and you can see that this is a story and it's believed in. And am I the one to tell them, no, this is not the case? It's a story that has value to them, like the scientific stories have value to me. So one of the things that I did, and it's the only piece of my experience that I want to expose you to, and again bring it up for discussion, I created these boxes to be a first instance of confrontation with what science is. And there's something in these boxes, something in this box as well. There are about 7 or 8 of those boxes distributed among groups of students, and told them there's something in the box, find out what it is without opening it. They could spend about 2 or 3 days even to do all kinds of experiments, create hypotheses about what's in the box, test those hypotheses, discuss among themselves, develop theories, and the whole enterprise of science is in the box, in fact. And it's surprising. And if you had more time and I had more of the courage to lead you to do this, we could have spent quite some time actually going through that exercise here. You'd be able at the end, and my students were able at the end, to actually make drawings of what was in there, to describe the substance of the objects that are there, to identify particular features of what they are, and then we opened the boxes, and yes, they came pretty close. Now, this is exactly what a research in the structure of matter, for instance, at the submicroscopic level, does as well. We can't see those things, we can't touch them, but we do investigate, we have ideas about what is in the box. So, through very simple means, one can do very relevant things, not so much teaching the facts of science or the explicitly teaching the principles of science, like providing a checklist of the steps you go through in doing experiments and creating hypotheses and testing those hypotheses, etc., etc., but doing it yourself, and while you do it, make it part of your daily life. I feel that it's part of creating the spirit of science. Another piece of experience that I would refer to, from the point of view of a teacher, is when I was asked at an earlier phase in my life to teach secondary school students who were not in a science stream, but rather in a classical languages stream. They were aficionados of Latin and Greek, but they were still supposed also to learn something about physics. And I was the person in charge of doing that. I was told, well, you can do anything you want because it doesn't count for their records. You do give them a mark at the end, but it doesn't necessarily have to be based on very profound measuring. And what you're supposed to teach them is just a low-level knowledge of what you would otherwise be teaching to students who are in the science stream. When I started doing that, I told myself quite quickly that I would be crazy actually to do that, because it had no value whatsoever for them in the first place, and for me even less. So then, thinking a little bit about what kind of people I was working with, those were people who were interested in antiquity, in cultures, in languages, and then I took the opportunity to actually learn what they already knew, and trying to relay that to the science that I was familiar with, physics. And we delved into the history of physics, what had actually happened in Mesopotamia, in ancient Greece, in Egypt, in the Muslim world, and how did mathematics develop, what did it mean, how did people interpret it, was it just science as we know it, isolated from everything else, or was it science integrated in much broader frameworks of thinking and emotions. And so we learned immensely, not only my students, but I too, by going through a different approach. And I felt, and I feel in retrospect, that by doing so, we contributed something to creating the spirit of science, that disposition that is in all of us, to explore the world and do so in the context of visions and of values that we share. So those are three elements that I put forward for discussion, and so I also want to briefly give you some idea of what my vision is of the mind. So that's the question. And first of all, the word mind is, you'll find it in the dictionary of Anglo-Saxon, it's gemind. And what does gemind mean? Gemind is memory. It's simply memory. Now, memory has different meanings, different connotations. There's static memory, like you find it on a computer chip, and there's dynamic memory, memory that is intentional, with which you do something, something that gives meaning. I quote here the person who was listening into this talk, my daughter Yusra, who once said to me, "We're all memories in the making," and she said so after the death of a close friend. Yes, we are memories in the making. We are memories made as soon as we die. So this is our unique opportunity in evolution to contribute something to the collective memory of our species, to the collective memory of humankind. It fits nicely also with the vision from a brain scientist, Susan Greenfeld, who had wanted to be here. She apologized. She couldn't because she was committed to other things at the same time, but otherwise we would have had the pleasure of having her here. She's written extensively on the brain, and not only as a pharmacologist, a chemist of the brain, but also as a someone who has developed a vision about what it means to have a brain and how that functions. And she emphasizes that our brain is not something that is static, that is built into us and innate, and we have it, and just like a ready-made computer, we start using it. No, it grows in us, and it has grown in us as a species along our evolutionary history. So we have this morass of circuitry that builds itself up in accordance with our experience, in accordance with how we interact with the world, and it's a reflection of our living in the particular world. It organizes itself according to the world, and eventually we start seeing the world, we start interpreting the world in according with what we have built in an evolutionary sense that already reflects the features of that world. So it's sort of a pulling ourselves out of that morass by our bootstraps. Mind, therefore, memory in that sense, in the sense that it grows, is construction of intentionality. It's never the same, and it evolves. And it allows us to partake in enhancing the existence of humanity, not just of ourselves. This fits nicely with a vision that I found in Yoruba culture, as expressed by Wole Soyinka, a Nigerian poet and philosopher and writer, who says that in his culture the world is divided in that of the living, that of the unborn, and that of the ancestors. So it places us between those two worlds, and about it he says, he emphasizes that our role is to enhance the existence while we are here, and it's the responsibility of us all to create a congenial environment in which that can happen. So here you see the vision of science actually nicely blend with a vision out of another form of expression, that of literature, that of philosophy, which obviously science also is. But it's very difficult to make a clear distinction between those different areas, and I think we came to that conclusion quite frequently, and I'm being reminded of the time also here. Mind and matter are related. Steven Pinker, whom you may know, says that mind is not the brain, but it's what the brain does. And there's also a quote here from Edelman, who says, "A special kind of process, a special kind of process depending on special arrangements of matter. It's all in the brain." obviously, but it's not the brain itself. I quote myself here to actually show that the scientific mind is an oxymoron. When we talk about a scientific mind, we should recognize that actually in the development of science, as we still mostly practice it, we try to separate the minds from what we do scientifically. This is based on Descartes' notions, which are still quite prevailing in the way that we work. And it's not bad, I mean, it's a tool and it's very useful, but we should also see its limitations. So by talking about the scientific mind, we are bringing two things together that actually don't go very well together. It's like military intelligence, it's also a nice oxymoron, or airline food. So there's this dualism of the mind here. You find this Descartes, painted by Frans Hals, a famous Dutch painter, who claimed that we should separate the res cogitans from the res externa, the things that are in us, in our cognition, the things that are in the external world. Yes, we try to do that indeed, but it's, as I said, it has its limitations. The man who was responsible for my own upbringing as a scientist, Professor Kronig, said it in another way when he took leave of his post at the University of Delft. He referred to the social sciences. He didn't mention the word there, but that's basically what he was talking about. He called them pseudosciences. Why? Because they, envious as they are, they try to create the same rigor as the physicists do, but they are bound to fail because the human being is a singularity, and as we physicists do, we put a small circle around the singularity, so you don't want to talk about it, and he advises us not to do that. Of the many useful pieces of advice that I owe to Professor Kronig, this one I didn't follow. So there are things that compel us to put the mind back into where it belongs, into nature. And first of all, that has to do with the advances in science itself. We have come, and this happened at the beginning of the 20th century, to the insight that while we try for analytical purposes to separate ourselves from our investigations, in the end it's us who are considering it, and we have huge problems of interpretation. They have to do with the language that we speak and the language that is developed on the basis of our daily life that does not necessarily correspond with the phenomena that we appreciate and that we study. So they require a different language, and indeed we develop a different language. Mathematics is a very useful tool and a very, very beautiful language to express things that we can't express in our own language, and we haven't found the ways to entirely translate those languages into each other. You always lose when you translate from one language in another, and you certainly do when you try to translate from mathematics into the words that we speak in daily life. Doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to do it, but the mastery of that language is something of beauty that people can aspire to, and again is part of building the scientific mind. I think maybe I could go on for quite a long time, but as I have sitting the man with the bell next to me, I think I should. Oh, the bell is there, so I can't be punished yet. But there are many such thoughts that I would like to share with you. But perhaps it's more interesting from this point onwards, also recognizing the profound contributions from my two colleagues, to stop at this point and enter into a discussion on the various aspects, not only those of my own presentation, but also those of Eric Ross and Joel Wiesen, invite to sit at the table so that we can enter into a dialogue. And I would ask Ron actually to facilitate the dialogue. Thank you.
So.